COVID-19 is already taking a toll on America's food supply, and it could get worse. It's not that there isn't enough. The Guardian reports that billions of dollars of food is going to waste from Florida to California. That's because restaurants and schools and stadiums and theme parks and cruise ships have shut down, and they used to consume almost half of all the food grown in the country. So updating the supply chain and getting the food to where it's needed is a major challenge. But now consider this. Farm workers are among the most vulnerable of America's essential employees in terms of health care and living conditions. If the pandemic strikes, let's say in California's Central Valley, and keeps them out of the fields, would that be an even more basic risk to the food supply? I asked that question of The Guardian's Susie Cagle, Irene de Barraicua of Lideres Campesinas, and David Puglia, who's president and CEO of the Western Growers Association. Dave Puglia, you first.
Clearly the answer is yes. Our farm workers are really the front line and the first responders, if you will, to ensuring that fresh fruits and vegetables reach Americans across the country and people around the world for that matter. If we were to see a major reduction in their ability to continue the noble pursuit that they're pursuing today, as we are all sheltering in place, they're in the fields and they are continuing to put themselves at some risk to be able to keep those supply lines open and keep the healthiest food we should be eating coming to the grocery stores. If we were to see a major impact to their ability to continue doing that, the short answer is yes, commodity by commodity. We would start to see reductions in supply and price increases, at least for the short term and maybe longer than that, depending on which commodity we're talking about. And I think many of us would be forced to change our diets, to be blunt about it, and start moving to things that aren't quite as healthy, more packaged and processed foods in the middle of the store and spend less time on the side of the store where the fresh produce is. That's not good for any of us. And something we obviously are trying to avoid.
Okay, so the answer is clear enough to the major question. Susie Cagle, quickly, at The Guardian, based in Oakland, do you have anything to add to that, based on your reporting?
Yeah, I would just say that it's not just if the farm workers become ill themselves, which of course they're at risk for just being out doing their essential work every day, but also with all of the new stress of this of the coronavirus response and shutdowns. If they need to care for children that are no longer in school, or if they have financial difficulties because of having to care for ill loved ones. These are people who it's a large undocumented population that is not going to be able to access federal benefits that other Americans are going to be able to access. And they're at greater risk of not being able to work just because of those impacts.
So, Irene de Barraicua, you represent the people that Dave Puglia describes as being on the front line. And tell us, you have sent a letter to Governor Newsom, and interestingly enough, also to Mrs. Newsom, Jennifer Newsom, his wife. What have you asked, and how did you describe the situation of farm workers, and particularly women?
Yes, thank you, Warren. We did. We addressed many of the concerns that, you know, we didn't come up with these ourselves. It was more through phone calls and conversations with the farm workers themselves. So these worries, these fears, they're compounding, you know, one on top of the other. And this also in itself can affect the food system, right? This stress and the feelings that the farm workers are going through daily. So we wanted to kind of pinpoint the main ones, and that's what we addressed in the letter. And one of those was obviously the stress of not having maybe the adequate health education, just because we are dealing with a large amount of individuals who do not have the same kind of access to healthcare. And so getting that education and then having them worry that maybe others don't take this as serious and they're working side by side with them. And so we addressed all of these things in the letter, and we thought, you know, what better than to address the First Lady from, you know, on behalf of an organization of women farm workers and their families, right? We just, and this is all something that I feel is a concern for growers as well. And it's just kind of a letter to the state, to the communities, to allies, for everyone to work together. And so I could go over, you know, the concerns.
Well, you set it up very nicely. And I will ask you about some of the other things that you wanted to see done. But with regard to this question of education, Susie Cagle, let me go back to you. Who has the major responsibility to educate farm workers, particularly many people who are sometimes undocumented, as was indicated, but also who often don't speak English?
I think that, you know, there is no clear legal responsibility for them, but certainly many farm workers work for farm labor contractors who work for the growers themselves. They're not employed directly by growers, which means that those labor contractors are in a position of being responsible not just for the education for farm workers, but also for their safety. They're responsible for making sanitization available to them and any sort of protections that they need in the fields. And so those kind of middlemen contractors become really important in a situation like this, which means that kind of the availability of that education can vary really widely from contractor to contractor.
So, Irene, who do you hear is in the field providing this education, and how adequate do you think it is?
So what we are hearing is the supervisors, the foremen, in Spanish it would be the mayordomos, right? And, you know, they do the education at their discretion, of course, because not even myself could I go out there and do a proper, you know, education regarding coronavirus. And I've been doing webinars since before this really, you know, was an issue, you know, widespread and made very public. But our concern, I guess, is getting them perhaps healthcare professionals and welcoming them to the field, where it's a time of urgency to where, you know, temperatures should be getting taken and just a little more quality control in that aspect. Because right now, what I think it's changing gradually, daily, everything as everything else is. And we are happy to hear that, you know, just by conversations and meetings. And so I think for all areas, all sectors, all industries, these guidelines are changing. I have faith that, you know, maybe more healthcare professionals will be coming to the fields and just assuring that maybe that the standards, the guidelines are being abided by. For, you know, social distancing and working far apart, which I know is very difficult in some, you know, like the crops, certain crops and the work. So
Dave, you're president and CEO of the Western Growers Association. Does your organization and do the individual farmers have a responsibility to take a role in this, even though, as was indicated, it's the farm labor contractors, the in-between people who have the most immediate contact with the laborers themselves?
I think Irene said it very well. Just to be clear, many farm workers are employed by farm labor contractors. Many are not. Many are employed directly by farmers or shippers, as we call them in our industry. So it's a mix. But the fact of the matter is, as Irene said, there is an obligation to do much more and much more meaningful education and training as fast as possible. Things are changing very quickly. But we have a host of resources that we've put to our members, and all of the feedback we're getting from our members is that they are soaking it up. They are deploying that training into the field as fast as possible, as effectively as possible, with a very large population of workers and multiple languages. So it is improving day to day, and I think the commitment is certainly there, no doubt about that. And I would say one other thing that was mentioned, you know, I think we share a very serious concern about the stress that workers in agriculture are feeling right now. We all have some degree of anxiety, but these are people who have really much tougher rows to hoe, pardon the pun, than most of us do. And they're struggling with things like childcare no longer being available and the schools are closed. We immediately started advocating to the Newsom administration and to the federal government to try and find some quick relief to provide emergency daycare for essential workers across the economy. And of course, that starts with farm workers. I'm very happy to see that Governor Newsom issued an executive order I believe it was yesterday, providing emergency resources for childcare for essential workers. So those kinds of things are where we can really band together and provide as much help as possible to these good people when they're working in the fields during a really tough time. The other thing I would mention is that, as I think Susie noted, many of these workers are here without proper documentation. That's going to make it very difficult for them to access the same emergency benefits that legal residents can access. We have been working for a long time with our partners in the United Farm Workers Union and others who ordinarily we may not be seen as partners with, but working towards immigration reform that would provide legal status and a pathway for the people in our industry. It's really long past time that we get that done. The House of Representatives passed legislation late last year, mid-year, H.R. 5038. Congresswoman Zoe Lofgren from San Jose is the lead for that, but it also enjoyed the support of a couple of dozen, almost three dozen Republicans in the House of Representatives. We really need the U.S. Senate to take up the matter now and get serious about immigration reform for agriculture. This is an industry that has made its case over and over again. We know that these people are working hard, they're paying taxes, they're doing right by this country, yet we still haven't provided them legal status when we know Americans won't take those jobs. It makes absolutely no sense.
Susie Cagle, let me go back to you. No disrespect intended to Dave Puglia, but you and I think, have been covering for a long time the farm situation. I certainly have for many decades. And these issues keep coming back again and again and again. The conditions under which the farm laborers work, the fact that so many are undocumented, the susceptibility that occurs for them to be basically abused, particularly by the farm labor contractors, but not necessarily with the growers and the farmers doing anything about it. How likely do you think it is that there's going to be major change anytime soon?
Gosh, you know, I think that at least in this situation, this is the coronavirus shutdowns have been a crisis, not just for these essential farm workers, but also for the entire agriculture industry. Growers are hurting too. There is a lot of focus nationwide on the security of our food supply chain. People are worried about the availability of food in general. And so I think there's a lot more eyes on this situation and on these workers than perhaps there would be in any other time. So I guess that makes me a little bit more optimistic than I might otherwise be about folks getting the kind of safety training that they need. And perhaps there being a little bit more scrutiny on growers who and contractors who might otherwise not be doing right by their workers.
That's great to hear from both of you. Irene de Barraiqua, to what extent do you think coronavirus is in fact present now in the fields of California? Do you have any idea? Has anybody done a survey of how extensive it is?
You mean in terms of actual workers having coronavirus and having been diagnosed?
Yeah.
Yeah, we've been having, you know, these conversations and just kind of trying to monitor as best we can. And definitely there's some surveys that are going to be implemented by, you know, other organizations regarding just general situations, issues revolving around it. I am, you know, in conversations with someone that is in quarantine and he works in the almonds. And that's a big concern, you know, because these are people who are, you know, not, he's waiting a week for test results. He can't afford the medication that he's being given. The Mexican consulate had to step in and help pay for this. He doesn't even have money for the 7-Up that they recommended that he buy. He doesn't have money for his rent, for his phone. You know, so these are people who, even if they don't have the coronavirus, some that have the certain symptoms that may, you know, be associated with them later are quarantined so they can't go to work, or, you know, by law they're told, you know, also the doctor's telling them you have to be completely quarantined even from any housemates. So it's just a huge stress. Aside from that, yes, 8 people in Coachella Valley in the packing houses, you know, just on Thursday it was 4, on Friday it became 8, And that's what we're really wanting to prevent. And that's why we believe that the healthcare professionals coming to the field and really stressing the importance, because like I said, you know, these are people who normally don't go to the doctor when they feel ill. These are people who desperately need to work to survive. They don't have the same benefits as other, you know, American citizens have, right? The stimulus checks and everything. So they're, like I said, their problems are compounded, which also that stress adds to the weakened immune system in itself, as do already pre-existing health conditions from working in the fields, like pesticides, exposure, right? Like the valley fever, so many things that really they need to kind of just be given this kind of care. Right now is the time for growers to show we care about you. And if healthcare professionals are coming there, to just welcome them and let them get the little spiel, whatever it may be. And if it may be, you know, taking their temperatures and making sure others are not having these symptoms and are not having fevers of 100 degrees or what it may be, you know, that limit. So yeah, we are very concerned about the spread of this inside of the packing houses, the farms, the workers, and then to their families and then to the overall community. So very good question.
When you talk about quarantining, particularly from housemates, and when you talk about education, which might include staying 6 feet apart, is it even possible to work in many of these places and be 6 feet apart? And when you talk about quarantine, people, as I understand it, live with two or three families in the same house, and that they have to be transported from workplaces in vans, which contain seven or eight people at the same time. Irene, is that right?
Yes, in many cases, you know, we have different populations. You have H-2A workers, right, which are the guest worker workers that come on visas. So a lot of times they are in housing kind of labor camps or housing developments that are sometimes, you know, just a little more crowded, or they're traveling on buses. And so all of those things, maybe Anthony could answer a little bit better on in terms of what the current practices are in the area of H-2A. But others, yes, they do live in houses with their families, with different people. So it's also very difficult to kind of isolate completely and quarantine. And then when they need that someone to care for them, right, they just don't have the same access to help. Also the language barriers. Also their families have to go work. Everybody's dealing with the same kind of issues of almost unable to, you know, survive. And so one cannot really help the other because it's a huge crisis that they're in. I mean, usually one loses their job in agriculture and they run to the next, you know, field or crop, and they can easily get picked up. But it's not the case right now.
So, Dave Pooley, let me go back to you. Language was mentioned again, and you pointed out, I said Spanish, you pointed out there are multiple languages involved. We're talking about a pretty desperate situation, it seems to me, that's basic to the way that agriculture has been working. Do you think there are going to be serious changes as a result of this, and the attention that will be brought to it, and the risk that there is to the entire food supply?
I think change is inevitable. I think that every sector of the economy is going to come out of this doing some things differently that had never been contemplated before because we were forced to. I think in our industry, you know, as I mentioned, we've had a chronic and worsening labor supply problem now for over a decade. And that has, I think, really pointed to the need for greater innovation and technology and the way we produce our food, the way we harvest food, to reduce the risk to humans. This is very hard, arduous work. There's always a question, how much of this can be automated, and how much can we help those people find other employment opportunities other than in the fields? And I think, you know, this is another one of those moments in time that sparks greater investment in technologies that can reduce the impact to our fellow humans in a very tough situation. So I think that's one thing that comes out of this. I will say that in some cases, I'm already aware when we talk about proximity and trying to create social distancing, it is difficult in this industry, but people are doing things that probably wouldn't have been contemplated before. For example, I know of one farmer who has started using 4 buses to transport workers as opposed to 1 bus. So just creating that greater separation for that part of the day when the workers are on buses, obviously that creates a lot more cost and inefficiency, but it's worth it, obviously, to give a little bit greater protection against transmission of the virus. So I think the short answer is yes, there will be changes that come out of all this, and hopefully they're all positive. But I don't think we can sit here today and predict with any certainty what those changes will be. I just have a strong sense that the ongoing investment in technology in this industry will be even more of a focus coming out of this.
Will that, though, reduce the number of available jobs?
Well, you know, the question is, are those jobs still going to be there in 10 or 20 years anyway? The workforce has been declining in the fresh produce industry, especially now, for quite a long time. The average age of a farm worker in California, if I'm not mistaken, is now 47. 10 years ago, it was in the high 30s. Mexico's economy is improving. There are fewer people who want to make that journey across what is basically a secure border, and the dangers that come with crossing that border. So, and we're not attracting Americans to these jobs, even though pay has gone up year over year in the fields. If you are a strawberry picker on the Central Coast right now, you're going to be making at least $20 an hour in most places, maybe a little less in a couple others. But it doesn't matter how much farmers are offering in terms of wages. We're not attracting Americans to the fields. We haven't. And that's just never been a job that Americans do, which is too bad. But the reality is we rely on people who are migrants, recent migrants, or as Irene noted, temporary guest workers on the federal H-2A program to harvest our food.
Irene, what would those people do if, in fact, there were more mechanization, more technology, more innovation of the kind that Dave Puglia is talking about? Those who are residents of this country, citizens of this country, not necessarily the people who come across the border.
I think, you know, we've already been seeing this transition to automation, right? And so many, and also just, you know, people have been actually even going back to Mexico, we've seen in statistics, because they're finding better work there. And they've been naturally just kind of transitioning from agriculture, which I think has affected farmers as well in the last years. Just this, you know, a lot of the younger kind of generations aren't really getting that much into the farm work. So they've been transitioning into other industries already, I think. And that's why I think it caters probably more to undocumented immigrants. So aside from that, I think it's a good question. In the current today, I'm not sure what, you know, people are doing, except just finding work in other industries. And in the, you know, it could be domestic, it could be construction, right, restaurants. And so, yeah, I think that's a great issue to discuss and look further into.
Susie Cagle, what about the farmers markets? We've talked in terms of sort of an industrial approach to all of this. The farmers markets operate somewhat differently. Are they threatened at the moment?
They certainly have been in parts of California and the rest of the country, as people are concerned about social distancing and minimizing their trips outside of home. People are less willing to go to the farmers markets, where there are many smaller growers who don't have those big retail market contracts, who maybe relied on food service that has now just been decimated, and direct to consumer sales. And a lot of those farmers markets are busy in some places, but they also, some of them have been completely closed. So many small growers in California and in other parts of the U.S. Are kind of overnight revamping their business models, trying to become community supported agriculture, doing boxes delivered to direct to consumer, just a whole new distribution model to make up for the 50% of the produce market that has essentially been closed indefinitely.
Dave, in the letter that Irene's organization sent to the governor, they asked not only for health professionals to come into the fields and try to help people better understand what's going on, but some other things as well, that people not have to show doctor's letters in order to demonstrate that they are sick, that they have access to bathrooms with soap and water and toilet paper, that they have protection from law enforcement, letters perhaps that they can carry indicating that they are in fact essential workers, so it's okay for them to be on the roads and on their way to and from work, and maybe even help in shopping hours, because they of course work such long hours themselves. They often, particularly the women involved and single women especially, can't get to the grocery store. How likely do you think it is that the state might in fact try to provide those kinds of things, or get your members in the Western Growers Association to provide them?
And there are good points. We've done quite a bit of that already. We drafted template letters for essential workers to be able to carry and provide those to our members. And our members are putting their letterhead on those templates and giving them to their workers if they want them. Some workers don't, but most do. And so they've got them in hand now. And I think that's relieved some of that concern. We've advised our members not to require doctor's notes when an employee takes sick time. And from our surveys, most of our members do not require those. So it's a practice that we would continue to encourage, not requiring doctor's notes for sick time.
Do the labor contractors necessarily go along with that? They're the middlemen here.
I would say I can't tell you one by one. I know some of them, and the ones that I know are very, very responsible and go along with that advice, but I can't speak to all of them.
Okay. Susie Cagle with The Guardian in Oakland. What's the next story you're going to do? What are we going to have to do another podcast on as this situation develops?
Just thinking about that half of the produce market that is gone because food service is closed, that has ripple effects across the supply chain, both, you know, in the direction of the consumer and also in the direction of farm workers, as we're worried about their essential work. There is also the issue of availability of work, because growers that aren't receiving orders from restaurants don't have work for those farm workers in the fields. But right now, nationwide, those growers still have food in the ground, and they don't necessarily have the money to pay people to harvest it. So there are some that are actually plowing food under, millions of pounds of squash and green beans in Florida. Growers in California are dealing with backlogs and cold storage. We're missing that link in the supply chain of getting that food somewhere to people who need it, at the same time that we have, you know, record lines in demand at food banks across the country. So it's a really tricky time for, I think, everyone in the entire food supply chain.
All right. Nothing is more basic than food. Nobody is more essential than the farm workers who provide it, along with the other people in the distribution chain that I mentioned at the outset of the program. I want to thank you all very much for being with us and invite you all to come back again. Susie Cagle, again, covers the climate and the environment for The Guardian. She's also obviously covering the situation we're talking about. Dave Puglia is president and CEO of the Western Growers Association. Irene de Barraiqua is with the Lideras Campesinas, an organization of women farm workers. Thank you all so much for being with us. Great to talk with you.
Thank you, Juan.
Thanks.
Thank you all.
Now there's another threat to the food supply. Cases of COVID-19 have shut down several meatpacking plants across the country, and it's clear that the pandemic is going to be with us and interrupt our food supply for a long time to come. That means more unemployment, uncertainty, more fear and instability. It's bound to be especially difficult for the mentally ill, and it could increase their numbers. In a moment, a judge in Miami who's working to help such people out of the justice system and provide the resources that they can use to help themselves. Back in a moment with To The Point. Warren Olney back with To The Point. Jails and prisons have become America's de facto mental institutions. Some 50 million people suffer from mental disease, and they're much more likely to face cops and sheriff's deputies than they are to get treatment. The results can be tragic, but not in Florida's Miami-Dade County. The Miami-Dade Criminal Mental Health Project has found a way to reduce crimes and recidivism by mentally ill people. It also reduces police shootings at the same time it's saving money. It's the subject of a documentary airing and streaming this week on PBS stations called The Definition of Insanity. We'll hear about that in a moment. But first, here's Stephen Lifeman. He is judge of the 11th Judicial Circuit in Miami-Dade. The Criminal Mental Health Project began 10 years ago on his initiative. Judge, welcome to our program.
Thank you for having us.
How did you get involved in this in the first place?
It actually started with a case that I had. I was getting ready to go into court, and I was approached by the lawyers from the public defender and state attorney's office, and they said, Judge, we just spoke to this couple, and you have to hear their story. And this lovely couple came into my chambers, and they started to tell me about their son who was in jail that day on a ridiculous minor offense. And they started to tell me how he'd gone to Harvard, he had a late onset of schizophrenia. Turned out that he was a psychiatrist at our local public hospital. And he just vanished. And it turned out that he had cashed in his life insurance policy. He was having what we call religious ideations, needed to be closer to God, so he flew to Israel. And within 3 weeks, the Israelis deported him back to Miami because he was running around naked in the Orthodox sections of Jerusalem. And he came back as a homeless man and now was in front of me on this case. And to make matters worse, the law in Florida did not really have a way to deal with people that were this acutely ill that were charged with low-level misdemeanors.
Let me just stop you for one moment and point out that what this suggests is that anybody is subject at any time, or many people are at least, to mental illness totally by surprise.
Absolutely. And it doesn't discriminate. It doesn't discriminate on race, wealth, religion, gender, everybody is vulnerable. And what made matters worse in this case is I had to release him back to the street without any services after I had promised them that I would get their son help. And it really became a kind of a window into everything that was wrong with our mental health system. And, you know, I think one of the best things about being a judge is when we call people to meetings, they come. And so I invited all the traditional and non-traditional stakeholders to a two-day summit. And we brought in some outside experts from Policy Research Associates. And we literally mapped out how our criminal justice system intersected with our community mental health system. And what we found is that we, like most places, are just embarrassingly dysfunctional. I'll never forget, this is in the year 2000, we stopped at one point and looked at each other, and after we had mapped out how poor our system was, and we asked, who's more sick? You know, the so-called policymakers that had designed a system designed to fail, or these poor souls who were just ill, recycling through our systems every single day without access to the treatment they needed for recovery. So that's how we got started.
So now the man you started out with didn't go to jail, at least not immediately, but a lot of people do. What happens to them when they are in jail?
He did go to jail. In fact, he
spent— Oh, he did? Okay.
Oh, yeah. He was in jail. In fact, I was handling a misdemeanor jail division at the time. And so there were people, these are people in custody on misdemeanors that can't get out.
For what you described as a ridiculous crime.
Yeah, it was like possession of a dairy cart. It wasn't even a statutory offense. It was a local county ordinance that's often used to pick up homeless people. And most counties have them. And, you know, sometimes the police do it because they think, you know, that when they pick the person up, they're going to get help. They have no idea that the system is as bad or as insane as it really is. And so, unfortunately, we were not unique, and it's pretty typical around the country.
pretty typical around the country. There are several cities that have enormous jail houses full of mentally ill people. I know in Los Angeles, for example, there's one called the Twin Towers, a jail called the Twin Towers, and there's something like 3,000 people in there every day.
Yeah, you have the largest psychiatric warehouse in the country in your jail. It's you, Chicago, New York's gotten much better, and we've really significantly reduced ours. But it is an issue because people don't know what to do because the capacity doesn't really exist on what to do for them. Most of the systems around the country are based on what we call acute care, emergency care. And so there's really not a good continuity of care. So once people leave an emergency system, they don't get what they need. And so if we would start thinking about these issues as illnesses and not crimes, and develop a coordinated system of care, we would get much, much better results. It's like diabetes, you know, it doesn't go away. If you take your insulin, you have to manage it. And this doesn't go away either, but it can be managed. And what most people don't appreciate is that recovery rates for this population is actually better than for people with diabetes and heart disease. And so the key is identifying these illnesses early, putting people into a good system of care and helping them manage their lives because they can live very fulfilling lives with good treatment and recovery.
I think the idea of, I'm sorry to interrupt you again, but just the idea that people can recover from mental illness is not generally accepted by a lot of people. They think that once you're mentally ill, you're always going to be mentally ill.
Well, you'll just like once you have diabetes, you do have diabetes, but it can be controlled. And it's the same thing with these illnesses. You know, I have 8 peer specialists. These are people with lived experiences that some of them are featured in the documentary that are living with very serious mental illnesses, but are having amazingly complete, fulfilling, happy, and healthy lives because they're in treatment and in recovery. And they are a testament of what treatment can and should do.
How did you figure that out? What is the Miami-Dade Criminal Mental Health Project? How does it bring together the criminal justice system and the community mental health system?
Yeah, it's a great question because it's not about building a mental health court. That's a very small part of what we do. It really required a major systematic change in the community. And so we began with a 2-part approach. If I were to do it again, I would do a 3-part approach, which I'll talk about in a second if I get a chance. But first, we wanted to reduce the number of people coming into the system. We did not want to incentivize people to have to get arrested to get treatment. So we adopted a program that began in Memphis called Crisis Intervention Team Policing. It's a 40-hour training program where we teach our law enforcement officers how to identify someone who's in crisis, how to de-escalate a situation, and where to take them as opposed to arresting them. Unlike Memphis, who has 1 police department, we have 36 here. We're huge, not on the scale of a Los Angeles, but we are a huge community. But over time and with the assistance of my state attorney, Kathy Rundle Fernandez, in a grand jury report, we actually were able to have a grand jury report insisting that our law enforcement start to use this CIT program. And so we now have the largest trained squad in the country. We have over 7,500 police officers trained at all 36 at our departments. And over the last 8 years, the 2 largest agencies, which handle the bulk of our mental health calls, they handled 91,472,000 mental health calls. Yet they only made 152 arrests out of those 91,000 plus calls. And so our arrest in Dade County immediately went from 118,000 a year to 53,000 this year. And then what we did is we set up a post-arrest system. We changed the screening tools at the jail to make sure we were doing a better job identifying people when they came in. And if they met our criteria and they were on a misdemeanor, within 3 days we would divert them to one of our crisis stabilization units. And because they were on a criminal hold, the 72 hours of the most civil mental health laws did not apply, so we reset the cases for about 2 weeks, which really most of this population needs, and I'm sure Norm will talk a little bit more in a few minutes. The laws in this country are very antiquated and outdated and need to be modernized, and we can see that through what we're doing now. And then once they begin to stabilize, one of our team goes and sees them and offers them an opportunity to come into the program. And if they accept, which most do, they don't get rebooked. They get taken directly to court. And when they get to court, one of our eight peers are waiting for them with food, with clothes, with their medication, with transportation, with housing. And the peers begin to reestablish relationships with this very vulnerable population that has really been treated so poorly that they've just given up on life. And so they work on reestablishing the relationship and working with them to want to get better, so they'll start to take medication. And then the court will monitor them on a misdemeanor, usually about 6 months. And upon successful completion, we drop the charges in most cases. And then it works so well, our recidivism rate dropped from about 72 to 20%. The state attorney started to realize, hey, if you really want to improve public safety, get people treatment. And so she allowed us to expand it to nonviolent felony cases. That program has reduced recidivism to about 25% and has saved the county more than 84 years of jail bed days so far. We have closed one of our three main jails because of the project at an actual savings of $12 million a year. It's been closed now for 7 years. The number of police shootings have significantly increased. In your introduction, you talked about the interaction and how things often go wrong. But one of the other things that often went wrong is that the police, because they hadn't been trained, would overreact and often shoot the person with a mental illness because they inadvertently escalated a situation. And we've reduced our shootings from about two a month to maybe five or six in the last 8 years. And so we know it works. We still have some ways to go, and we'll talk about it in a few minutes about some of the other aspects. But it's an enormously successful project, and you know, I really owe it to my staff, who are amazing people that work incredibly hard with a very difficult and vulnerable population to help keep them healthy.
Was it originally difficult, and is it difficult now? To train police officers to de-escalate. We hear about people who become cops because they want to get tough and so on and so forth. Certainly that's not true of all of them, and probably only of a very few, but enough that it would seem to me make it difficult to train large numbers of them to approach people in the way that you suggest.
So you touched upon a really fascinating part of what we do with a fascinating, unanticipated consequence. So at first they were reticent, but it turns out that we had not realized the level of PTSD among police officers. So last year, more police died from suicide than in the line of duty. And they have nowhere to go. The stigma is even worse among them in their profession. They rarely will go to their departments for help because they're afraid of losing their jobs and their identity. And there's a lot of frustration as a result. And we think some of the shootings that we see around the country may be related to PTSD almost more than anything. And so what we did is, because the woman that runs my program for CIT, Hopsy Cobb, is amazing. And she's like, Judge, I'm getting more than 150 calls a month from police officers for their own personal mental health issues, and I don't know what to do. So what we had to do is we went to the Association of Police Chiefs and we let them know what was going on. And we said, hey, let us set up a treatment program for police outside the department. They have insurance, which they allowed us to do. And so now we're getting all of these officers treated. And they've become incredibly empathetic. We keep so much data that you can now see that you're the cool cop. If you get hit or pushed by someone with a mental illness and don't arrest them, and you're kind of the wimpy cop if somebody pushes you with a mental illness and you make the arrest. The whole culture has changed. And I think our law enforcement particularly really respect and appreciate that we're looking out for our first responders. And so we've been able to develop this amazing relationship. They're there for us when we need them. And they really go out of their way to help this population in ways that you couldn't imagine.
We're talking with Judge Stephen Lifeman once again about the extraordinary Miami-Dade Criminal Mental Health Project, extraordinary if it does nothing more than change the culture of the police department. That in itself is pretty dramatic. Also on the line is Norm Ornstein. He's a resident congressional scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. And he has set up a foundation, which is called the Matthew Harris Ornstein Memorial Foundation. I'll let him tell you about that. But he also has spearheaded a new documentary that I mentioned earlier called The Definition of Insanity that's going to be airing on PBS this week and streaming as well on PBS stations. And Norm, it's always good to have you on our program.
Always a pleasure, Warren.
How did you get involved? How did you get interested in the idea of doing a documentary like this one?
Well, you know, to tell you the truth, Warren, I would have been much happier if I hadn't done all of this, because what motivated me was the death of my son 5 years ago, January 3rd, 2015, my son Matthew. Matthew, just like the young man that Steve Lifman told us about earlier that started his journey, was a brilliant young man, a national champion high school debater, went to Princeton, had great success, went out to Hollywood and was doing well, and at age 24 had a psychotic break. We'll never know what caused it. Also, religious ideations, believed that God had come for him, had taken his soul, but not his body. And he went on a journey to try and find out how he could get his soul back. But a part of his brain disease, and I'll say as an aside, I try to call it more brain diseases than mental illness, because in some ways people think that mental illness is something you can overcome by sheer will. As he went through his struggle, I can't tell you how many people, well-meaning people, smart people said, why don't you just kick him in the ass, as if he were consciously doing what he was doing. We called what he had stage four brain disease. But part of it is called anosognosia, which is that you have no insight into the fact that you're ill. When people tell you you're ill, you think that they're the ones who are deranged. And if you're over 18, you will not get treatment. You refuse it. And the system is shattered in so many ways. But one part of it is that we had no way to help. And we're a family with resources and connections, and none of it made a difference. Over 10 years, he struggled, he deteriorated, and he died accidentally. It was carbon monoxide poisoning, really driven, though, by his lack of judgment from his illness. And we created this foundation that you mentioned in his memory. And we've decided a phrase that I now use because somebody who was actually very good to us after Matthew died, Joe Biden, referred to it when he was talking to another person who'd suffered a different kind of tragedy in Florida, Fred Gutenberg, who lost his daughter in the Parkland shooting. And he said, you're turning grief to purpose. And we decided we weren't going to just crawl up into a corner and go through the anguish that we've gone through, but try and do something positive to help other families.
Let me just interrupt you by saying that you are so brave and so remarkable to be as forthright as you are and to try to turn grief to purpose. It seems to me, I just have to make that observation as we go along. And go ahead. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I just had to make that comment.
Thanks, Warren. You know, it's painful to talk about it, but you know, when I began to talk about it, which was really triggered by members of Congress coming to me because what became the 21st Century's Cures Act, the federal action that actually was the first one to try and deal with the problems of serious mental illness, was foundering in Congress. And they said, can you help? And after a lot of soul searching and anguish in our family, I wrote a piece in the New York Times that talked about Matthew. And the response that I got was overwhelming. And it was so many people saying, I've never told anybody this, but, and then referring their own family tragedies or stories, or others saying, I have a child and we're struggling terribly. And I thought we were alone. The stigma that surrounds these illnesses is so powerful. And forcing oneself to talk about your own tragedy really does make a difference and reduces the stigma. So right after I wrote this piece, I was at a program where Steve Lifman was getting the award as the best state and local judge in the country. And they did a panel before the award ceremony at the Supreme Court. And actually, I bonded with his mother, who the family from Minneapolis, where I'm from. And then Steve and I talked and we exchanged a lot of information. And then Judy and I, my wife and I, went down to Miami to immerse ourselves in the program. We're blown away by it. And I came to realize that partly from the responses I'd gotten from my op-ed in the Times, corrections officers, the chief corrections officer in the state of South Carolina called me and said, what can we do about this? I've got a jails that are filled with people with mental illness. We don't want to have that happen, and we don't know how to deal with them. And when I told him about the Miami model, as we call it, he had no idea. And I thought, what's the best way that we can spread this remarkable program that this remarkable judge has created? And the power of film is one way to do it, not just to show the film, but then to use it as a catalyst around the country. And we got this very talented filmmaker who had known my son from growing up in high school, Gabriel London, with his partner, Charlie Sadoff. And that's the genesis of the documentary. And I will also say that I, you know, took it to the public broadcasting system and to Sharon Rockefeller, who's the president of the Washington station, WETA. Her son, Justin, had gone to Princeton with Matthew. Sharon has had her own tragedies in life, losing her sister. And we are friends, and she embraced this, and they've made this a core part of what the station does and the system. Under Paula Kerger, the president of PBS, has stepped up to the plate also. And I think we're going to have some real resonance here because it is an extraordinarily powerful movie with incredibly powerful people.
Let me just interrupt for a moment and say to our listeners that you are hearing a little trouble on the line. We're all doing the best that we can to put together as good a program as possible. The subject is just so important. You can understand what everybody's saying. It hasn't become difficult at all. It's a little annoying, but thank you for being patient with it because I think what we're talking about is just so important. And Judge, why do you think it is? You've been doing this for a long time. People such as we just heard describe, sheriffs around the country, haven't heard about it. And they all must be having the same kinds of problems that you illustrated, not just crowded jails, but also cops with PTSD and the other issues that can be coped with, not to mention the victims, the people who have mental illness and who are simply abused by a system that, as you described it, is set up to fail.
It's starting to change. Really excited, and one of the another horror of this terrible pandemic that kind of put the brakes on a major initiative that I was working on, where we got a grant from the State Justice Institute, and we were halfway through, or a little less than halfway through, of training every chief justice in the United States on this project. Wow. And they have fully embraced it, and we're starting to do statewide summits and getting their judges educated about this issue. And so I think in 10 years, we're going to look back and see a very different world when it comes to this. I'm actually cautiously optimistic. And, you know, because it's a nonpartisan issue, it affects everybody. David Satcher, the former Surgeon General, said that mental illness is the silent epidemic of our times. But if you work in the criminal justice system, there's nothing silent about it. We hear their cries and their screams every single day, and everybody from the most toughest person you've ever met to the most sympathetic person you've ever met realizes that this is just wrong and that we're not doing anybody any good. And not to mention, the cost of doing it wrong is in the billions and billions of dollars. And the cost to do it right is significantly less. That will actually create revenue, not take away. And so last year in the United States, the counties collectively spent over $50 billion in jail costs, and the state spent another $71 billion in prison costs. And much of it is due to untreated mental illnesses and substance use disorders. And so if we start to apply a population health model and start to treat these illnesses, or as Norm says, diseases, as illnesses, we're going to get much better outcomes, save a lot of money and save a lot of lives, and actually improve our public safety, not make it worse by doing what we're doing now.
And let me just review quickly what we've heard, which is that shootings are down dramatically, particularly police shootings of mentally ill people. Arrests in Miami-Dade County have fallen from 118,000 to 56,000 a year. Recidivism is down from 80% to 25% among people who have been arrested and who are mentally ill and who have completed the program. Norm Ornstein, tell us just a little bit, if you will, just give us a hint about what's in the new documentary, The Definition of Insanity. I should say that Rob Reiner is the narrator of that piece.
You know, Rob is a friend and did this just because he's a really good person. So I'm indebted to him. But, you know, this, we wanted to make a film that wasn't just a dry documentary showing what's been done, but that really focuses on people. Some of them are people who are a part of the program, the remarkable people that Steve talked about. And for example, the one peer specialist, there are several of them in the film, but Justin Volpe, who's an incredibly charismatic young man who is in dire straits, another onset of serious mental illness, a schizophrenia, went through the program, and now is a superstar, helping other people and living an extraordinarily productive life, and a charismatic young man. Actually, PBS and WETA, we did some separate interviews with some of these people, and there's one up on the Facebook page that's gotten close to 30,000 hits already of Justin. Cindy Schwartz, who runs the program for Steve. There are people who are in the program itself, and there are some great success stories, people who come through. That's not always entirely smooth. These are not diseases that are just turned on and off like a switch. But you see how, if you can do a program of this sort, you can take lives and make them productive again. And then you have, as well, the state's attorney, a very tough lady who has bought into this program instead of just having the typical prosecutorial reaction of, I want more convictions because that's what helps. We have dedicated defense attorneys. We have this remarkable woman, Hopsy, who runs the crisis intervention team policing program, the 40-hour program, and some of the police officers talking. And what's particularly interesting here is hearing one of the police going through the program saying, you know, we're not trained for this. And as police, we have to wear so many hats, and now we have to wear a white lab coat, and saying that he'd learned more in this week of training than he had in 9 years on the highway patrol. And when you see people, real live people, their lives changed, in some instances as law enforcement people, judges who understand that now they can focus on redemption as well as just being the arbiters, lawyers who see that working in partnership instead of being just adversarial all the time can result in better outcomes, and people whose lives are transformed by the program. You come away, there are heart-wrenching moments, but boy, it's a feel-good story in the end, Warren, and at a time when we need it, and at a time when, as you said earlier, with the coronavirus, the most vulnerable populations, the homeless population, the prison population, so many of them people with brain diseases who are more vulnerable, we need to do something now in triage, but here is a model that can work to lessen the impact down the road.
Well, it's extraordinary to hear what you have to say about the whole situation, and very particularly what's available in the definition of insanity. Once again, that's the name of the documentary that's going to be on PBS stations all this week, streaming as well as being broadcast. And I want to thank you both very much for being with us today. Again, Norm Ornstein is with the American Enterprise Institute, and he's head of the Matthew Harris Ornstein Memorial Foundation, instrumental in getting the documentary put together. And Stephen Leifman with the 11th Judicial Circuit in Miami-Dade County, Florida, who is the inspiration behind this extraordinary project, the Miami-Dade Criminal Mental Health Project, which it seems to me ought to be adopted in every jurisdiction in the United States. Having said that, thank you both very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Now, please don't forget that there is a very important documentary airing and streaming on public broadcasting stations right now. It is The Definition of Insanity, voiced by Rob Reiner, inspired by the man we have just been speaking with, Norm Ornstein. It provides extraordinary insight, I think, into the way that we treat mental illness in the justice system in the United States, and it's very well worth watching. As I've said before, we're not going to let social distancing prevent us from podcasting. Even though we do have a glitch or two from time to time, we're doing the best we can, and thanks so much for your patience. I know what we have is of interest to you, and importance, too. Our producer is Andrea Brody, our engineer is Chuck Prebatary. We're at tothepoint_KCRW. You can tweet me at WarrenAlney1. Thanks so much for being with us. This time around, join us again.